Hello, and welcome to the history of Rome. The founding of Rome is an event wrapped in myth. Lacking a credible historical record, it is impossible to know exactly what led to the establishment of the Eternal City, but we do know the legend the Romans told themselves, and have some idea of the population migrations that took place in central Italy at the time, so we can piece together a general timeline of events. There may be truth wrapped up in the official legend, and there may not, but it is a good story and an important one to know for students of ancient history. It is the story of a refugee Trojan prince and how his great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandsons would be wet-nursed by a she-wolf and later found the greatest city of the ancient world. The story of Rome begins with the end of the Trojan War. After Troy was finally sacked by the Greeks, Aeneas, chief lieutenant of Hector, managed to escape with a few followers. They boarded ships and set out into the Mediterranean to find a new home. Their odyssey took them from Asia Minor to the north coast of Africa, where Aeneas managed to sow the seeds of the three Punic Wars by seducing the Carthaginian queen Dido and then abandoning her. Virgil writes that in the final moments before she committed suicide, Dido cursed the descendants of both to eternal enmity. O my Tyrians, besiege with hate his progeny and all his race to come. Make this your offering to my dust. No love, no pact must be between our peoples. No, but rise up from my bones, avenging spirit. Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. After securing an archenemy for Rome, Aeneas sailed to the west coast of Italy, where he and his followers hoped to make a settlement. Arriving in the territory of Laurentum, the Trojans were immediately met by armed locals who tried to drive them off. But their king, Latinus, decided to make peace rather than war with the foreigners and offered his daughter Lavinia to Aeneas, solidifying an alliance. This marriage came as quite a shock to Turnus, prince of the Rutuli, a nearby tribe, because Lavinia had already been pledged to him. Angered by this slap in the face, he led an attack on the combined Trojan and Latin forces. The Rutuli were defeated, but King Latinus was killed in the fighting, leaving Aeneas in control of both the Trojans and the Latins, who were rapidly intermarrying into a single people. Vanquished, Turnus and the Rutuli turned north to the rich and powerful Etruscans for help. The Etruscans were more than willing to lend a hand against the growing menace of the Trojan-infused Latins and attacked. But Aeneas, in his final act, led the Latins to victory, establishing the Tiber River as the boundary between the Latins and the Etruscans. We should pause the legend here before we get too far and give an account of the political landscape of pre-Roman Italy as historians and archaeologists understand it today. Who were the Latins? Who were the Etruscans? Where did they come from and what sort of lives did they lead? The origin of the Etruscans is debatable. However, DNA evidence points to a migration from Asia Minor, which, if true, offers a context for the legend of Aeneas' arrival from Troy. The Etruscans were the dominant force culturally and politically in the Italian peninsula and, as we will see, came to dominate Latin territory in the waning years of the Roman kingdom. They had developed cities and a confederal state system long before the Latins, who remained in traditional tribal affiliations until the foundation of Rome, which was the first major settlement in Latin territory that could be called a city. The Etruscans were artists and craftsmen, who had set up extensive trading networks that reached all the way to Greece. The trading roads between Etruria and the Greek cities of Magna Graecia in the south ran right through Rome, offering a clue as to the reason for its location. The Latins, in contrast, were simple pastoral herdsmen. Evidence from ancient burial mounds suggests the Latins were descended from Balkan migrants who crossed the Adriatic in prehistory. Mostly shepherds and farmers, they did not have any sort of advanced arts or crafts. What culture they display seems to be little more than a blend of Etruscan and Greek elements. Indeed, nothing about later Roman history suggests the Latins were innovative at all in art, religion, or letters. They excelled at warfare and engineering and administrating, but were merely students of philosophy, never instructors. Their gods, to take one obvious example, are little more than an adaptation of the Greek pantheon. Zeus becoming Jupiter, Hera becoming Juno, and so forth. What bound the Latins together was a common language, distinct from the Etruscan language to the north and the imported Greek in the south. Latin, of course, forms the basis for half the languages in Europe, and its vocabulary still dominates the legal profession. But enough humorless anthropology. After Aeneas died, his young son Ascanius grew to be king. The town built by the Trojan settlers had become too small for the exploding population, and Ascanius led a group east to found a new settlement called Alba Longa, which would become the seat of the growing Latin kingdom. Generation upon generation followed, and the Latins became powerful and secure. The kingship was passed from father to son until finally it rested upon the head of a man named Numitor. Numitor had a brother named Amulius who coveted the throne and decided to seize power for himself. Numitor was driven from Alba Longa, all his sons were killed, and his daughter, Rhea Silvia, was forced to become a Vestal virgin to ensure she would bear no children who could threaten Amulius. However, after taking the vows, Rhea was the victim of rape and consequently gave birth to twin boys. Rhea declared that the god Mars was the father, but to no avail, and, for the crime of allowing herself to be raped, she was thrown in prison. The twins were sent to be drowned in the Tiber. However, the men entrusted with the task found the river flooded and left the boys in the sluggish water rather than slogging their way to the river itself, and when the waters receded, the babies were left alive and well in the reeds. Here, legend states that a she-wolf, coming to the river to quench her thirst, found the babies and offered her teats for them to suckle on. A herdsman came upon the scene and gathered the children up from the wolf who had been gently licking them and took them home with him. Even Livy acknowledges that the story of the wolf is a fable and postulates that it may have arisen because the herdsman's wife was a whore named Wolf. The herdsman and his wife raised the boys, named Romulus and Remus, as their own, and soon they grew to be men. Apparently the boys took a liking to fighting the local brigands who raided the countryside and began taking the fight to the robbers, raiding their camps and stealing from them. The criminals, angered by the theft of their booty, set a trap for the twins. Romulus managed to escape, but Remus was captured. The brigands took Remus to the local landowner, who turned out to be none other than the exiled Numitor, and claimed Remus and his brother had been caught stealing Numitor's cattle and that he should be punished. Numitor was immediately reminded of his twin grandsons and, realizing that they would be the same age as Remus was now, began to suspect that the boys were his blood. Numitor began making inquiries and soon learned the particulars of their upbringing and became convinced that they were his daughter's children. The herdsman, knowing Remus was in Numitor's custody and having himself long suspected that his two boys were of royal blood, decided to tell Romulus the whole story of their discovery by the river. From this, a plan was hatched to return Numitor to the throne. With Romulus leading one group of men and Remus another, they surprised and killed Amulius and brought Numitor back to Alba Longa. Numitor told the story of his brother's treachery and the circumstances of his grandson's birth, and the people shouted unanimous consent that Numitor be king once again. After Numitor became king, Romulus and Remus decided to found a new settlement at the spot where they had been left to drown. There are two accounts of what happened next. One states that trouble arose when the question of who would be senior in the new city was raised. They decided to allow the gods to decide, and each retired to the top of a hill, Romulus the Palatine and Remus the Aventine, to await a sign. Soon enough, six vultures landed at the feet of Remus, and when his followers made this known to Romulus, 12 vultures immediately landed at Romulus's feet. A fight broke out, with one side claiming primacy of arrival and the other claiming primacy of number. In this fight, Remus was killed. The other, more famous story is that Remus, mocking his brother, jumped over the partially completed walls, and Romulus, in a fit of anger, killed him, swearing, "So perish whoever shall overleap my battlements." Either way, Romulus obtained sole power, the city was named for him, and he became its first king. The legendary date of foundation is April the 21st, 753 BC. Did it happen like this? Almost certainly not. After the sack of Rome in 386 BC, most of the early historical record was lost, and with it the specifics we need for an accurate telling of the story. But archaeological evidence seems to support the broader strokes of the legend. Settlements have been found on the Palatine Hill that date from the 800s BC, suggesting that the legendary chronology is at least in the ballpark. The general story of a struggle between the Latin and Etruscan people, ending with ostensible Latin autonomy south of the Tiber, also fits our understanding of the ethnic and cultural landscape of the era. It is doubtful that the site of Rome was chosen because it marked where the twins had been sent to die, more likely an easy river crossing, coupled with the natural defenses offered by the nearby hills drew settlers to the area. And of course, as already noted, the site lay on the trade road between Etruria and Magna Graecia. Without any real data to draw from, later Roman historians used common mythological elements to construct a conventional founding legend. Indo-European culture produced numerous examples of the divine twin mytheme, including Castor and Pollux, and Idas and Lynceus of Thebes. The motif of infant exposure gone wrong crops up in the biographies of both Perseus and Moses. And of course, most will recognize the virgin birth element from Christianity, but tales of miraculous or virgin births have surrounded important legendary and historical figures for millennia. The addition of Aeneas gives Rome a lofty ancestor and connects their city to the Greek civilizations the Romans so admired. However it happened, a settlement was established at the bend in the Tiber. This settlement grew and came to dominate its neighboring communities, then the entire Italian peninsula, then the entire Mediterranean. Next, we will cover Rome's unsavory beginnings, who the first Romans were, whose women they stole to ensure that there would be a second generation of Romans, and whether Romulus, great soldier that he was, died or simply faded away. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Last time, we discussed the events that led up to the birth of Rome, covering the arrival of Aeneas into Italy and the story of the twins, Romulus and Remus. Today, we will cover the remainder of Romulus' life, his questionable morality, and his ultimate disappearance from the world of men. After Romulus founded the city, it became apparent that he would need to attract settlers in order to ensure its survival. To this end, he opened up the city to what could tactfully be described as colorful characters, but, put simply, they were the dregs of society. Fugitives, escaped slaves, debtors, and criminals all flocked to the new town to start fresh, and Romulus welcomed them with open arms. The first order of business in true Roman fashion was to establish an army. Romulus sifted through his new subjects and divided them into able-bodied men of military age and, well, everyone else. Most sources agree that the first legions consisted of 3,000 foot soldiers and 300 cavalry, but accounts differ as to whether there was initially just one legion or whether there were many. Soldiers in those days had to equip themselves, so only well-to-do citizens could enlist, with the richest citizens serving in the cavalry because they were the only ones who could afford horses. This meant that the interests of the army were, in those early days, firmly squared with the interests of the society it defended, at least the middle and upper classes of that society. In later years, the legions were filled with mercenary soldiers, whose interests often diverged from those of the actual citizens of Rome, who had long since given up fighting for themselves. Here the seeds would be sown for civil war, decline, and ultimately destruction. But for now, Rome's army fought for the people, not against them. From the remaining motley assembly of those not called to arms, Romulus created a council of 100 senators to help him govern, either because that number was enough for his purposes, or because there were only 100 men respectable enough to be given such responsibility. The descendants of these men would become the patrician class of later Rome, who would find themselves constantly at odds with the plebeian class, the descendants of the remaining unwashed masses. Rome was now ready to defend and govern itself, but there was just one problem. The new arrivals were almost entirely male. Without any women around, the dream of Rome would die after a single generation. So delegations were sent around to the neighboring communities to ask for intermarriage rights, but wherever they went, they were refused. Fathers did not want their daughters married to the Romans, who, after all, were nothing more than a collection of despicable cast-offs. The Romans resented these rejections, and so Romulus thought up a surefire way to acquire wives for his people. They would steal them. The Romans invited all the neighboring communities to a great festival honoring Neptune. They spared no expense in preparing and promoting the celebration, and on the appointed day, a great crowd filled Rome, including, famously, the Sabines. All was going well and no one suspected a thing, until Romulus suddenly gave a signal, and the men of Rome seized all the visiting women they could capture. The festival was broken up and the parents of the seized women fled the city, cursing the treachery of the Romans. The seized women were naturally horrified at their predicament, but Romulus went to them and claimed that it was their parents who were to blame, because they had been too proud to wed their daughters to Roman men. Further, he said, they would all be treated better in Rome than anywhere else, because the Roman men would feel obligated to work off the guilt over what they had done. Apparently this mollified the women, but it did nothing for their parents and brothers. Attacks followed in succession from the victimized communities, but each was repelled by Romulus and the Roman forces. Finally, only the Sabines had not yet sought revenge. They waited and planned rather than immediately taking up arms. When the time was right, the Sabines bribed a young girl to let them into the citadel of the city and took it before the Romans could react. Romulus immediately mustered his army and launched a counterattack. A brief battle was joined, but neither side could gain the upper hand. Finally, the Sabine women, daughters of one side and husbands of the other, intervened, throwing themselves between the two, pleading with them to halt. Livy writes, "We are mothers now," they cried. "Our children are your sons, your grandsons. Do not put on them the stain of parricide. If our marriage, if the relationship between you, is hateful to you, turn your hatred against us. We are the cause of strife. On our account, our husbands and fathers lie wounded or dead, and we would rather die ourselves than live either widowed or orphaned." Their entreaties moved the opposing armies, and peace was made, ultimately joining the Romans and Sabines into one political entity. The abduction episode has lodged itself in the Western imagination, commonly referred to as the Rape of the Sabine Women. The event has been depicted by countless painters, including Nicolas Poussin, Jean-Paul Rubens, and Pablo Picasso. Jacques-Louis David depicted the conclusion of the story in his Intervention of the Sabine Women. Anyone who has read Watership Down will remember that the entire second half of the book is taken up with an adventure to secure female rabbits for the new Warren, no doubt taking its inspiration from the Roman example, although in that case Hazel and his followers were far more ethical in their solution. After the Sabines joined with the Romans, a power-sharing agreement was reached, and Romulus agreed to rule jointly with Tassius, the Sabine king. The newly integrated citizens of the city were divided into three tribes, the first being made of Romans, the second Sabines, and the third the remaining population, mostly of Etruscan origin. 100 leading Sabines were then added to the Senate, doubling its size. Leadership thus established, Romulus formed the first great citizen assembly, the Comita Curiata. To do so, he divided the tribes further into 10 curiae, naming each one after an abducted Sabine woman, to honor them for their role in the peacemaking. Each curiae cast one collective vote, making for 30 total, and the assembly was tasked with electing various magistrates and enacting routine laws. Thus the original political constitution was settled. The kings reigned supreme, but, from the beginning, both aristocrats and commoners were involved in the legislative and judicial functions of state. It was at this point as well that the legions doubled in size to approximately 6,000 men, a number that would stand for the remainder of the empire. The power-sharing agreement with Tassius lasted all of 5 years. The Sabine king, for whatever reason, assaulted some envoys from Lavinium, and when he later arrived in that city for routine religious services, he was set upon by a mob and killed. Romulus, not seeking war with Lavinia, and no doubt secretly welcoming the death of his rival, did nothing to avenge the death of his co-ruler. The Sabines were outraged, but fear of Romulus's power and his apparently divine mission held their tongues. Romulus now reigned supreme once again. For the next 40 years, the Romans fought continuously against hostile neighbors, usually Etruscan cities in the north. By the time of Romulus's death, he had made the Romans a power to be reckoned with. The details of his passing confirm his status as a mythological figure. One day, seated on the throne, he was reviewing his troops and a storm kicked up. Thunder clapped, and Romulus was enveloped by a cloud. When the storm dissipated, the throne was empty, and Romulus was gone. The senators who stood beside him searched, but no trace of Romulus was ever found. Livy notes that Romulus was always more popular with the people than he was with the Senate, and that it is entirely possible he was murdered by the senators who stood beside him. I find it part of Livy's charm that he would go out of his way to offer a more plausible explanation for the death of such an obviously fictitious character. The life of Romulus is a convenient myth. Who founded Rome? Romulus. Where does the name come from? Romulus. Who organized the legions? Romulus. Who divided up the tribes, organized the Senate, and began the citizens' assembly? Romulus, Romulus, Romulus. It is possible that the stories grew from the life of a real person, but most likely Romulus was created out of necessity to answer questions later Romans had about their own past. It seems comically naive of the Romans to believe that so much could be owed to a single man, but when we look at our own almost religious veneration of George Washington, it begins to make sense. In 500 years, will historians be reporting that George Washington was born of a cherry tree and had wooden teeth to prove it, that he flew over the Delaware River, defeated the British Army, and designed the Constitution all by himself? It seems crazy, but as time goes by, the subtleties of actual events are compressed into small digestible units. Horatio Gates has already been pushed from the collective consciousness and is known only to historians, but it was his victory at Saratoga, not Washington's, that led the French to support the revolution and thus ensure its success. That story, though, is too complicated. Most Americans don't even know how critical French involvement was, let alone that Washington had little to do with securing it. Washington beat the British. That is the story of the American Revolution. As the years pass, will the name of Madison be lost? Hamilton? Even the great Thomas Jefferson, whose fame is second to none, may yet fall under the juggernaut that is this mythical Washington, as he, like Romulus, becomes the answer to all questions about the founding of America. Countless hands working patiently over years no doubt transformed Rome from a collection of shepherds into a regional power, but their names have been lost and their deeds have been rolled into the biography of a single mythical man. The early days of Rome stand in stark contrast to its later greatness. To say that the mighty empire came from humble roots would be a gross understatement and entirely misleading. I've always found it odd that more was not done to alter the details of Rome's unsavory beginnings. Founded by a man who killed his own brother and was raised by a whore, the city's initial inhabitants were thieves, crooks, and beggars. Such an unappealing lot that they could not find a single woman who would have them, they resorted to kidnapping. To protect their ill-gotten wives, they then proceeded to make war on their new in-laws. There is not a single sympathetic figure in the whole bunch. You almost find yourself rooting for the Etruscans to put this rabble down and restore some decency to the world. But alas, the Romans were strong and would not be conquered, even if they were total bastards. And this is the moral of Rome's birth. The Romans won and grew and thrived, not because they were right or good or moral or God's chosen people, but because they were strong and knew how to win in battle. Might may not make right, but it will make a thousand-year civilization. Join me next time as we discuss Romulus's successors to the throne, Rome's religious awakening, and how the kings were finally run out of town. A transcript of this podcast and additional information can be found, as always, at thehistoryofrome.blogspot.com. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Last time we finished with the death of Romulus, first and greatest king of Rome. Today, we will cover his first three successors, who they were, and what roles they played in the evolution of Roman law and society. I call this section the Seven Kings of Rome because common historical nomenclature always refers to the Seven Kings of Rome, so though we will only be talking about three kings, it seemed appropriate to use the phrase as a title, even if it isn't technically accurate. Just remember, there were seven kings of Rome. Oh, by the way, in reality, there were almost certainly more than seven kings of Rome. The idea that seven successive kings could reign for an average of 35 years each stretches credulity. Nowhere else in the history of mankind have seven monarchs in a row managed such continuous good luck. The stories handed down to us of Numa and Hostilius and Marcius and the Tarquins are no doubt apocryphal, meant to cover the ground between Romulus and the founding of the Republic, while explaining the evolution of the city's culture at the same time. So just remember, even though there weren't really seven kings of Rome, there were seven kings of Rome. After Romulus died or disappeared, there was a crisis. Who would lead the Romans now that their first and only king was gone? Trouble arose not just from the question of which particular man would reign, but also from the question of what tribe he would be from. The Sabines, who would suffer the sole rule of Romulus in silence, now wished to see one of their own placed upon the throne. The Romans found this idea preposterous, but the Sabines refused all Roman candidates, and the Romans, in turn, refused all Sabine candidates. To avoid a slip into anarchy, it was decided that each senator, in succession, would reign for a single day, until an acceptable man was found to rule. This was the first instance in Roman history of an interregnum, or period between official sovereigns. A compromise was finally proposed that allowed the Romans to choose whomever they wished, without Sabine veto, as long as the man was a Sabine. The Romans agreed to this and picked a man of universal renown, Numa Pompilius. The Sabines, delighted by the choice, agreed at once, and messengers were sent to Numa to present him with the good news. To the amazement of everyone, however, Numa refused the offer, and it was only after much cajoling that he agreed to take the throne. You see, Numa was a bit of an odd bird. He disdained all luxury and had devoted his life to religious contemplation. He often took long walks alone, and it was believed that on these strolls he conversed with the gods. Not that this concerned anyone, quite the opposite, it only enhanced his reputation that the gods spoke to him, but still, not exactly a man you usually find at the head of a growing military power. Numa did not even live in Rome. He resided in a nearby town and was, for the most part, put off by the violence and greed of the city. This second king of Rome was the opposite of Romulus in almost every way. Where Romulus was brash, Numa was reserved. Where Romulus was a warrior, Numa was a pacifist. Where Romulus sought glory and fame, Numa sought peace and solitude. Overnight, he changed the trajectory of Rome's march to greatness. When Numa arrived in Rome, he found a warmongering population of brutes who had known 40 years of war, and when he died, he left Rome a population of farmers who had known 40 years of peace. The remarkable transformation was due entirely to Numa's introduction of religion to the city. He turned the people's attention away from the battlefield and towards the heavens. Desiring peace more than anything else, Numa devised complex religious rites to occupy the time of the now demobilized army so they would not grow restless and provoke unnecessary wars. He instilled in the Romans an everlasting fear and awe of the gods, which would last for the remainder of the empire. Numa is credited with the foundation of the most important religious institutions in Rome. He imported the Vestal Virgins and established the laws governing their watch over the eternal flame. He created the office of Pontifex Maximus, the high priest of Rome, who would be responsible for the maintenance of all religious services, and, in an act of remarkable foresight, declined to serve in that role himself, establishing a sovereign religious realm that could not be meddled with by future kings. He believed that later kings would be so caught up in war-making that they would neglect their religious duties and bring the wrath of the gods upon the city. The office of Pontifex Maximus would remain an independent authority until the title was claimed for the emperors by Augustus at the dawn of the Imperium. At the end of the empire, the title was passed to the popes, who hold it to this day, 2,600 years after its inception. Just as Romulus is the answer to all questions about the founding of the city, Numa is the answer to all questions about the origin of religious practices. Who divided regular days from holy days? Numa. Who created the priesthood of Mars? Numa did. The priesthood of Quirinius? Numa. Who built the altar to Jupiter? Numa, of course. In the development of Roman culture, Numa is second only to Romulus in importance, and to some, he was even more important. Machiavelli writes, "And for anyone who considers Roman history carefully, it is clear how much religion helped in the commanding of armies, in inspiring the plebeians, in keeping men good, and in making the wicked feel shame. Thus, if one were to debate about the prince to whom Rome owed the most, I think Numa would sooner obtain the first place. For where there is religion, one can easily introduce arms. But where there are arms, but no religion, the former can only be introduced with difficulty." Perhaps Numa's most famous addition to Rome was the Temple of Janus. The gates of the temple were to remain open while Rome was at war, and be closed in times of peace. For the entirety of Numa's reign, the doors stayed shut. But after his passing, they remained open almost continuously. Numa's dream of peace, it would seem, died with him, and his reign would be an anomaly in Roman history. Of Numa's Rome, Livy writes, "Once Rome's neighbors had considered her no more than an armed camp in their midst, threatening the general peace. Now they came to revere her so profoundly as a community dedicated wholly to worship that the mere thought of offering her violence seemed to them like sacrilege." Numa reigned 43 years and died in 673 BC. His successor to the throne, Tullus Hostilius did his level best to banish forever this image of Rome as a city of docile farmer priests. Just as Numa was the opposite of Romulus, Tullus was the opposite of Numa. He longed for a return to the martial virtues of Romulus. He believed Numa had left the Romans soft and dangerously unprepared for what Tullus saw as inevitable attack from eternally hostile neighbors. The peace of the previous decades could not hold forever, and if Rome was to live, it had to fight. With this in mind, Tullus looked around for a clash that would reinvigorate the warrior spirit of his people, and found it in the place of Romulus's birth. A cattle raiding dispute along the border between Rome and Alba led to mutual recriminations, and for Tullus, this was enough of a pretext and war was declared. He even managed to arrange things so that the Romans looked like the aggrieved party who were being dragged against their will into battle. Armies from both sides advanced on one another, but before the order for full-scale engagement was given, Metius, the leader of the Albans, approached Tullus with an unusual proposal. There was nothing to be gained, the Albans said, in a bloody struggle between two familial people when the Etruscans sat at both their doorsteps, eagerly awaiting any opportunity to invade. A fight between Alba and Rome would deplete the strength of both victor and vanquished, leaving the door wide open for the Etruscans to make them all slaves. Metius proposed that single combat should decide their quarrel. That way their respective armies could still keep the ambitious Etruscans in check. Tullus agreed reluctantly, seeing the logic of Metius's argument, though it would not be single combat per se that would decide things. Each army's ranks held three brothers, triplets, who were chosen to fight for the fate of their people. This fight between the Roman Horati and the Alban Curiati is an episode, like the rape of the Sabine women, that has found its way into countless works of art and literature, most famously in The Oath of the Horati by Jacques-Louis David, that great lover of antiquity. In front of the opposing armies, the two sets of brothers squared off. The fight was furious, and in quick succession, two of the Romans lay dead. Horatius, the remaining brother, knowing he could not take all three of his enemies at once, ran up a nearby hill, forcing the three Curiati to chase him. As the first neared, Horatius turned abruptly and killed him. The second Alban brother arrived too late to help, and Horatius fought and killed him as well. The third Curiati, weary from the chase and from wounds sustained in the earlier fight, was no match at all upon arrival. He fell to his knees, and Horatius did not fight him so much as execute him, plunging his sword down the poor bastard's throat. The Romans cheered their victory, and the Albans, grumbling at Metius's deal, were forced to withdraw and supplicate themselves to Roman rule. But Metius, aware of how precarious his authority was in the aftermath of this non-defeat to Rome, conspired to release his people from subjugation. He induced Veii, the nearest Etruscan city and, as we will later see, an important early rival of Rome, to attack the Romans. The Albans, Metius said, would be called upon to aid Rome, and he promised that at a decisive moment in the battle, the Albans would desert, leaving the Roman flank unguarded. Veii jumped at the opportunity to crush Rome and attacked immediately. Just as Metius predicted, Tullus called upon the Albans to join the fight, and the armies gathered to do battle. Just as the fight was about to begin, Metius ordered the Albans to withdraw. The Roman soldiers were shocked to see their ally suddenly leaving, but Tullus, thinking quickly, addressed his troops, telling them that it was his plan for the Albans to sneak around behind the enemy. The Romans, heartened, marched into battle with confidence and defeated the Veiites. Back in camp, however, Tullus ordered the arrest of Metius and had him brought before the Roman troops. Tullus then revealed the treachery of the Alban leader and, to the horror of his men, passed, without trial, a sentence of death by dismemberment. Their leader dead, Tullus then ordered the destruction of Alba Longa itself. He ordered the city destroyed and the citizens relocated to Rome where they would become Romans, forever wiping Alba from the map. Tullus ran 32 years and died in 642 BC. The return to arms was his lasting legacy, and the incorporation of the Albans was his most important contribution to the growth of the city. Henceforth, Rome's neighbors returned to their view of the city as little more than an armed camp and worked tirelessly to defeat the Roman menace. Never again would Rome enjoy an extended period of uninterrupted peace, despite the efforts made by Tullus's successor, Ancus Martius, the grandson of Numa, to bring the population back to his grandfather's vision of peace. Less is known, or told, about Ancus than any of his predecessors, but we do know that he attempted to follow in the footsteps of his grandfathers, but with far less success. Events conspired to force war upon him, and despite his natural proclivities, he accepted his fate and led the Romans into battle. A confederation of Latin communities who chafed under Roman dominance took Ancus's succession as the perfect opportunity to attack, believing they had another Numa on their hands who would be an easy mark. But Ancus accepted the challenge, and the Roman forces, battle-tested by their years under Tullus, routed each in turn. The defeated inhabitants were forced, like the Albans, to abandon their homes and settle in Rome, while Romans were sent to settle the vacated towns. Through this policy, the population of the city swelled, and the surrounding countryside was filled with subjects loyal to Rome. At the outset of the fight with the Latins, Ancus made his most important contribution to Roman society. Dissatisfied with the haphazard way war began between Rome and her enemies, he decided to inject a sacred ritual, introducing something of Numa into the barbarism of armed conflict. A specific formula was proscribed as to how exactly the Romans would declare war on an enemy. Too tedious to spell out here, but it involved sending envoys into enemy territory, announcing the war to the first man met in an official pronouncement, making more official declarations at appointed times, waiting 33 days, and finally throwing a spear into enemy territory, signaling the beginning of hostilities. The entire process may seem a bit overwrought, but it demonstrates the Roman desire to infuse all aspects of life with the rule of law, even if the end result was savage bloodshed. After the campaign against the Latins, Ancus won an important victory against the Veites, gaining control of the Maetian forest and extending Roman territory all the way to the sea. The consequences of this event cannot be overstated. Through Ostia, the port town founded by Ancus at the mouth of the Tiber, all initial Roman forays into the Mediterranean were launched and received. Ancus reigned 24 years and died in 617 BC. At his death, Rome found itself immeasurably strengthened by the addition of countless new citizens, a neighborhood free of enemies, and a port to call its very own. We will leave the story here and pick up next time with the final three kings, the Tarquin dynasty, the last of which would show himself to be such a tyrant that the very idea of monarchy would be hateful to Romans forever after, even forcing the emperors to semantically cloak their activities so as not to be accused of monarchism. As I said earlier, the lives of these kings are apocryphal biographies designed to explain the origin and development of Rome to later Romans. What is mostly being fleshed out in the story of these first kings is the relationship between the two most important pillars of Roman society, war and religion. The warlike Romulus is followed by the religious Numa, who is followed by the warlike Tullus, until finally the two pillars are joined in Ancus, the religious king who is dragged into battle by fate. This interplay is instructive and offers a neat encapsulation of their character. The Romans are a warlike people, tempered by religion, not a religious people forged into warriors. Ultimately, it is war, not prayer, that defines the Romans. Imagine if it had been the opposite, a people founded by a religious pacifist and succeeded by a warrior, who was then succeeded by a pacifist, who was then succeeded by a warrior, dragged by fate into a religious life. It paints a very different picture. The Romans are fighters through and through, though Machiavelli's point is well taken. Without religious tempering, it is doubtful the Romans could have sustained a republic based upon the rule of law, and would have remained an unremarkable tribe of violent barbarians. To sum up, the Romans were soldiers who took oaths seriously, not priests who took swordsmanship seriously. Join me next time as we discuss the last days of the Roman monarchy and what was so bad about Tarquinius Superbus, the last king of Rome, that led the city to transform itself into a republic that lasted for 500 years. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. So far, we have covered four of the seven kings of Rome: Romulus, Numa Pompilius, Tullus Hostilius, and Ancus Martius. Today we will discuss the final three, the so-called Tarquin dynasty, the father, Tarquinius Priscus, a decent if manipulative king, his adopted son and successor, Servius Tullius, and finally his real son, Tarquinius Superbus, who usurped his adopted brother and was then himself usurped by a fed-up mob, marking him forever with the infamy of being the last king of Rome. Lucius Tarquinius Priscus was born in Tarquini, one of the 12 cities of Etruria, the son of a Corinthian exile named Demaratus. Tarquin, the name by which history remembers him, was a shrewd businessman who became wealthy, but due to his racially mixed heritage, he was only admitted so far up the Etruscan social and political ladder. Angered at being denied the respect he felt he deserved, he decided to move to Rome, a city famous for offering men a fresh start. In Rome, Tarquin made an immediate splash. He gave lavishly, funding public projects, charities, and anything else that would bring him renown. It did not take long for Tarquin to come to the attention of Ancus Martius, the aging king. In his final years, Ancus brought Tarquin into his confidence, leading to a close relationship that resulted in Tarquin ultimately being made guardian of Ancus's two sons when the king died. Tarquin knew an opportunity when he saw it, and after Ancus died, he sent the two boys away on a hunting trip. He then lobbied the Senate to hold elections for a new king immediately to avoid any possible threat to the city brought on by the vacuum in leadership. Tarquin had made a lot of friends in the short time he had been in Rome, and his further generosity no doubt convinced any fence-sitters that he was the man for the job. He was selected in a landslide and became the fifth king of Rome. One of his first acts, demonstrating his characteristic shrewdness, was to expand the Senate by another 100 men, bringing their total number to 300. The new senators were wholly obligated to Tarquin for their positions and, predictably, supported him in everything that he did, leaving the Senate little more than a rubber stamp for Tarquin's policies. This could have proven disastrous if Tarquin had been an incompetent or tyrannical leader, but he proved to be a conscientious and able king, both as an administrator and military commander. Soon after his election, Rome found itself at war, again, with some of its Latin neighbors. Tarquin easily routed his opponents and returned to Rome with a great deal of plunder. He decided to celebrate his victory by throwing public games, the likes of which had never been seen. But there was no stadium large enough for Tarquin's vision, so he ordered a hippodrome built between the Palatine and Aventine hills. This hippodrome, when completed, would become known as the Circus Maximus, one of the greatest sports venues in the ancient world. It would remain in continuous use for the thousand-year existence of the empire. Immediately after work began on the Circus Maximus, Rome found itself embroiled in a fight with the remaining independent Sabine communities. They had never gotten over having half their population annexed by the Romans, and now sought to challenge the upstart for control of the region. Tarquin again led the Romans to victory, defeating the Sabines with strategy as well as brute force, destroying a bridge the Sabines had used to cross into Roman territory. Cutting off any escape route, he then smashed them against the river. To celebrate this victory, Tarquin inaugurated one of the most famous of all Roman traditions, the triumph. Later years would set guidelines for what constituted an official triumph, but the basic parts were put in place by Tarquin. The leader of the victorious army rides into the city on a chariot drawn by four horses. The legions follow with prisoners of the vanquished army and all manner of plunder seized from the enemy. To be awarded a triumph was the greatest honor a Roman general could receive. More will be said later about the traditional elements of a triumph, so for now we will simply note for trivia's sake that it was Tarquinius Priscus who celebrated the first one. Right around this time, a fantastic story reached the king. The head of a slave's sleeping child had suddenly burst into flames, though the child remained unhurt and did not wake up. Witnesses testified that they had seen the event with their own eyes and that the flames only disappeared when the child awoke. Tarquin's wife believed it was an omen of the child's future greatness and implored the king to adopt him so as to invite destiny into their house and not have it break down their doors. Tarquin agreed, and the child, Servius Tullius, was adopted by the king. He raised the boy as his own, and the omen bore out as the boy grew into a capable leader and eventual heir apparent to the throne. All was progressing nicely for Tarquin, but trouble was brewing. The sons of Ancus had not forgotten how Tarquin denied them their birthright, and resolved to reclaim what they felt was theirs. Knowing they could never get close to the king, the brothers enticed two men to do their dirty work for them. The two men arrived at the palace and pretended to have a loud quarrel, eventually demanding the king settle their dispute. Tarquin came to see what all the commotion was about and agreed to settle the fight. But as he sat to adjudicate, one of the men pulled out an axe he had hidden in his robe and lodged it in the back of the king's head. Tarquin fell, and the two men attempted to escape, but they were immediately captured. Tarquin's wife, Tanaquil, seeing the severity of the wound, immediately cleared the room and brought Servius Tullus in to help her tend to the king. Over the body, she told Servius that nothing could be done for Tarquin, but that it was imperative the men responsible for the crime should not sit on the throne. She implored Servius to take part in a charade to guarantee that neither of Ancus's sons would ever be king. Throwing open a window and addressing the crowd that had by this time gathered, Tanaquil told them that her husband's wound was only superficial and that the king would be back on his feet soon. In the meantime, she told them to obey Servius, who would act as king until Tarquin could resume his duties. At this point, of course, the king was already dead. Tarquin reigned 37 years and died in 579 BC. Servius performed the duties of king for a time as if he was merely acting in Tarquin's stead, going so far as to reserve judgment in some legal disputes, claiming that he must consult with the king. The sons of Ancus, believing their plot had failed and seeing Servius secure on the throne, went into exile. Not long after the transfer of power, Veii launched an attack on Rome, and Servius marched to meet them. Completely destroying the Veiian army, Servius returned to Rome a beloved savior. At this point, clearly in command of the throne, the death of Tarquin was announced. No one questioned Servius's continued reign as king, and the plan hatched by Tanaquil was brought to a successful conclusion. Servius would be the second to last king of Rome, and by all accounts the last good one. He was responsible for the final reconfiguration of Roman society prior to the establishment of the Republic, a reconfiguration that would have a profound effect on the way that Republic would ultimately be governed. Desiring to take stock of the city's resources, wealth, and population, he instituted the first census. Based upon the data he received, he divided landowning Romans, known as the Sidui, into five classes. Nominally divided by wealth, the idea was to establish who could provide what when war inevitably came knocking. The first class was the richest, able to provide a helmet, round shield, bronze breastplate, leg armor, sword, and spear. The second class provided all the same equipment as the first, save for the breastplate. The third provided the same as the second, but for the leg armor. Only a spear and javelin were required of the fourth class, and the fifth provided merely slings and stones. Sandwiching these classes were the richest of the rich, already separately designated as equites, cavalrymen able to provide horses, and the poorest of the poor, i.e., most of the population, who were exempted from military service. Men aged 18 to 40 from the five classes formed the legions when the need, which was often, arose. The classes did not serve a strictly military function. They also formed the basis of the new Roman Electoral College. The old tribal assembly created by Romulus, the Comitia Curiata, was surpassed by Servius's new Comitia Centuriata. Each of the classes were further divided into centuries which voted as blocks. The centuries, however, were not equal in size. The first class, which was the smallest, was divided into 80 centuries. The second, third, and fourth classes each had 20. The fifth, by far the largest, was composed of 30. The small group of equites were divided into 12 centuries, and the landless masses were granted just one. Elections being determined by a simple majority, the equites in the first class held between them all the votes they needed to control who would hold office and what policies would be pursued. There was some logic to the wildly skewed voting system. The wealthy shouldered the financial burdens of both state and military, and thus felt entirely justified in their stranglehold on power. The bulk of the population, however, would come to view the system as entirely unjust and would eventually have to take drastic steps for their voices to be heard. Servius's reign was progressing nicely. The Latin communities even contributed funds to build a temple to Diana in Rome, admitting once and for all that Rome was the capital of Latium. However, all was not well. Just as Ancus's sons were the undoing of Tarquin, so would the sons of Tarquin be the undoing of Servius. Servius believed he had covered this obvious threat by marrying his daughters to the two Tarquin boys, Lucius and Aruns. But this was not enough for Lucius, who felt he had been tricked out of his rightful succession, though his new wife was noncommittal about this alleged injustice. His brother Aruns, who could not have cared one way or the other, found himself married to a woman, Tullia, who resented his lack of ambition and admired Lucius's drive. Tullia further despised her own sister for not supporting an obviously great man in his quest for the throne. Evil took hold of them, and, not being particularly creative, they decided to simply kill their unwanted mates so they could be together and pursue the crown at full throttle. The newlyweds began a whisper campaign against Servius, pointing out his low birth and the fact that he had never been truly elected. To the richest in Rome, they alleged that the census was no more than a trick to expose their wealth so Servius could snatch it up and hand it over to his low-born friends. Lucius grew ever more bold as he gained support, until finally he decided to make his move. He went to the palace while Servius was away and sat upon the throne, demanding that the Senate assemble before him. When they did, out of a mixture of fear and confusion, he demanded they kneel before him and hail him King Tarquin. He was in the midst of a lengthy speech degrading Servius when the old king appeared, demanding an explanation. A scuffle ensued between the supporters of Tarquin and those loyal to Servius, and in the melee, the old king himself was struck and killed. Servius had reigned 43 years and died in 535 BC. Lucius would become known to history as Tarquinius Superbus, or Tarquin the Proud, the last king of Rome. From the start, Tarquin was the very model of a tyrant. He was vain, arrogant, pompous, and dismissive of both the people and the Senate. He built monuments to himself at the expense of the rich, using the labor of the poor. Smart enough to understand his shaky position, having seized power without so much as a nod to electoral formalities, he chose fear as the basis for his reign. He claimed for himself all legislative and judicial functions and dared anyone to oppose him. Those who did quickly regretted their choice. Tarquin arrested, tried, and executed his opponents, completely bypassing the traditional court system. He confiscated property whenever he saw fit and arbitrarily reduced the ranks of the Senate, leaving it anemic and unable to counter his actions. Tarquin's misconduct was not confined to the city itself. He sought to consolidate Rome's power over Latium and to this end called a council of the local nobility. He let them sit all day without making an appearance until one of them rose to declare that Tarquin was making them wait on purpose to show that he could order them around at will. Just then Tarquin finally appeared. The king made note of the man who had spoken against him and, after the meeting broke up, bribed one of the noble slaves to plant a cache of weapons in his master's room. The deed done, Tarquin recalled the council and announced that he had just discovered a plot against his life and fingered the offensive noble as its leader. They marched as a group to where the noble was staying and discovered the hidden weapons. That, coupled with his speech from the day before, was enough to frame the poor man, and he was immediately executed without so much as a trial. The remaining Latin nobility, whether they believed the charges or not, believed that Tarquin was capable of almost anything, and so did nothing to challenge his position in Rome. The city and surrounding countryside thus pacified, Tarquin sat back to enjoy the fruits of his labor. But only poison fruit can grow from such poisonous seeds, and Tarquin would soon pay the ultimate price for his underhanded tactics. Tarquin, obviously, had engendered no goodwill in the city, and the population waited only for a spark to light them into full revolt. Tarquin's own son would provide that spark. The young man, Sextus, was invited to a dinner party hosted by Collatinus, a local noble, and upon meeting Lucretia, the lady of the house, Sextus decided that he must have her. Inflamed with lust, he returned to the house while Collatinus was off laying siege to the nearby town of Ardea and raped her. His lust sated, Sextus rode off unaware of what he had set in motion. Collatinus, riding back to Rome with a certain Lucius Junius Brutus, was met by a messenger who bid him return to his house at once. There, surrounded by her father, Collatinus and Brutus, Lucretia told them what Sextus had done and then, overwhelmed by shame, grabbed a knife and stabbed herself in the heart. The three men, grief-stricken, stood over her body and swore that the Tarquins would pay for her death. Returning at once to the encamped army at Ardea, Brutus raised them into revolt with a stirring speech denouncing the Tarquins as oppressive criminals. He then led the army back to Rome, where he planned to expel the Tarquins once and for all. Arriving in the city, he marched through the streets and found a population slaving away on Tarquin's various pet projects and ready for revolution. Tarquin, at this point, having heard of the mutiny in Ardea, had ridden out to take control of the situation, but instead found his army gone and himself in exile from the city he allegedly ruled. Tarquinius Superbus reigned 24 years and would die seeking, but never regaining, the throne. Back in the city, the liberated people declared the Tarquins enemies of the state and forever barred them from Rome. The Comita Centuriata was convened, and it was decided that kings should never again rule Rome, and that two men should be elected annually to be leaders, so that power could never again be concentrated in the hands of a single man. Collatinus and Brutus were duly elected and were inaugurated as the first two consuls in Roman history. The year was 509 BC, and the most famous republic in the history of the world was born. The story of the ill-fated Tarquin dynasty casts an interesting shadow over Roman history. Through the obviously apocryphal royal biographies, a general outline of actual history begins to emerge. As I said in Part 1, Roman culture was derived largely from Etruscan and Greek influences, so, as an instructive parallel, we are given the story of a family of kings who became masters of Rome after emigrating from Etruria and were descended from an exiled Greek. There, and the micro story of the Tarquins is the macro story of all Rome. This dramatic, if fictitious, account has roots in reality. Modern historians recognize the dominance Etruria had over Rome until the founding of the Republic. It is thought that Etruscan kings did indeed command Rome, and that they were rejected by a native population wary of their rule. Though the neatness of this account no doubt misses a reality filled with intermarriage and colliding cultures, making it hard to know who was a native Roman and who was a foreign Etruscan. The story of the kings also offers a moral that the Romans followed to great success and abandoned at their peril. Until the ill-fated Tarquinius Superbus, none of the kings had been the son of a previous ruler. Hereditary succession played almost no part in the ascension of the kings. Ancus Martius was the only one who was even related to one of his predecessors, and he was the grandson of Numa, not an immediate heir. This stands in stark contrast to the monarchies that emerged in the Middle Ages that were founded entirely on the passing of power from father to son, whatever the merits or abilities of the child. Gibbon famously marks the beginning of the end of the Roman Empire, with Marcus Aurelius's sentimental choice of his son Commodus and not another, more capable man to succeed the Imperium in 177 AD. The choice ended five successive transfers of power from the emperor to a man chosen on merit and not relation. The 100-year period of the so-called five good emperors marked the height of Roman power, wealth, and stability. History has shown again and again that the ship of state is well sailed when leadership is based on great ability and run against the rocks when it is based upon mere birth. The Roman monarchy was now dead, never to return. Next, we move on to the story of the Roman Republic and trace its long march through the Italian peninsula, across the Mediterranean, and into legend. Next week, we will discuss the first days of the Republic, who its initial leaders were, and what would happen to any man who ever again tried to make himself king of Rome.